This is five, entitled The Adolescent and His Culture, Part 1. Looking at the culture of the adolescent can be a little bit tricky because it can be so many different things. There can be so many different aspects of culture to look at. In this lesson, we will look primarily at the social setting in terms of culture and the religious setting in terms of his culture. There have been many pagan cultures in history. What makes the U.S. unusual a little bit is that so many claim to be evangelical in their philosophy, and yet we are pagan. We're such a pagan culture. Christianity, though prevalent, has little effect on society and social policy. Some cities with very few churched people have far less crime than do cities inundated with churches. As you look at crime statistics around the country, at best, there's little difference between churched people, people who say that they go to church, perhaps even say that they are born again or evangelical, and cities where people say they are not churched or have no church home. Sometimes you'll find a city like Seattle, which I understand has very few churched people relative to the whole population, and a city like my own, Fort Worth, where people may say in the upwards of 85% or so say they are churched, and yet Fort Worth has a much higher crime rate than Seattle, or at least it did in the early 90s. So you have to ask yourself the question, why does church have so little effect on the community? We have to also see that society is a gift from God. We are social beings, and society can hold the best this life has to offer us before God. But we also have to understand that it also can be the world in the sense that Satan influences it and even to some degree controls it. Oz Guinness, in his booklet, The Devil's Gauntlet, recognizes this very thing on page 10, where he says, "Society is the devil's gauntlet thrown down before us to induce us toward his lordship rather than Christ's. But that is not because we are the innocents and the world is tempting. Rather, we are the temptable ones. The world is simply our hearts writ large. Our hearts are simply the world writ small. So our view of society needs to be deeply realistic. If society is God's gift to us, it is also the devil's gauntlet, and that bifocal vision should shape our perspective." Dr. Guinness says in this marvelous little booklet what many of us must hear concerning our society. He says that although society is a gift, it's also what the devil uses to get us to worship him rather than to worship Christ. So what does this have to do with teenagers or the adolescents that we counsel? Well, it has everything to do with them because they grow up here. If their parents are the ones, if we are the ones who are being inconsistent with our Christianity, we're training them to be just as inconsistent. We're training them that there's little effect or little connection between who we are as Christians and what we do in society at large. But let me share a few statistics with you from our modern society. These come from the U.S. News and World Report, as reported in the newsletter of Ligonier Ministries, September 9, 1991. Every day, 1,106 teenagers in the U.S. have abortions. Every day, 135,000 teenagers in the U.S. carry a gun to school. Every day, 10 teenagers in the U.S. are killed by guns. Every day, 54 teenagers in the U.S. are infected by AIDS. Every day, 6 teenagers in the U.S. commit suicide. These statistics suggest a culture which is violent, immoral, in despair. And if we are going to help stem the tide of many of these things in our counseling and in our work with youth, then we're going to have to understand society, both the positive and the negatives of society. One of the most frustrating things I found as a youth worker when I was working in a church and in a youth organization was that we could give them wonderful information. We could have them in the palm of our hands, but then we had to send them home to a society that was not beneficial in terms of living the Christian life. Some of them went home to terrible home situations. Certainly, most of them went back to terrible school situations in terms of living every day at the public school, or for that matter, the private school, and not having their Christianity held up in any way. In fact, often having it challenged, but certainly being challenged by the society in many ways. For instance, as I worked in a small West Texas town, I was struck with the fact that in this small, what some people would consider a small hick town, because it was basically an oil town that had somewhat dried up in the year since the oil prices were very high. Wonderful people, and we enjoyed our stay there. But to the outside, it looked like a very small, dusty West Texas town. And yet I found that the students in the high school there were often much more materialistic than the students in the nearest large metropolitan city. We would go visit the youth groups at the in the bigger city, and often my group would be much flashier in their dress, perhaps even flashier in the cars that they drove, wearing gold chains, etc., both the young men and young women. And it just reminded me that materialism is just as rampant in small towns as big cities, and that these issues of society are everywhere. No one can hide from them. We want to remember a couple of things about our culture and our society. First of all, as we've already said, that teens are not taught to think. They're not taught to think critically. They're not taught to think within an authority framework. The framework within which they learn to think is simply the worship of self. What do I think? And what I think is ultimately what matters most. What they have been taught in terms of thinking, or perhaps you might say non-thinking, are slick, pat answers to tough problems. They've been taught that life is supposed to feel good and to be fair. They've been taught that feelings can be trusted, and you must go with your feelings, as some would say. And they've been taught situation ethics, that right and wrong sometimes is determined best by the situation you're in and making a decision based upon the situation, that there are no absolute laws that govern you wherever you are and whatever you do. And of course, when we talk about the cultural societal situation, we also must talk about the cultural religious situation. Here, just for matters of simplicity, I've separated the two, but they're really not separate. Religion is a part of society, society a part of religion. Again, in The Devil's Gauntlet, Oz Guinness has said on page 13, "As modern followers of Christ, we constantly face a peculiar temptation to break the link between belief and behavior. We do it as adults. We teach our children to do it themselves as young adults. We teach them that what you believe and what you say you believe sometimes is not what you do." In a larger book, No God But God, edited by Oz Guinness and John Seale, the editors have commented on the current evangelical situation. They say, "If the nation's crisis is largely because of the decreasing influence of faith on American culture. The church's crisis is largely because of the increasing influence of American culture on the Christian faith. The overwhelming majority of Americans, more than 85%, still identify themselves as Christians. But if the statistical indicators of faith are up, the social influence is down and the reasons are becoming plain. There has been a carelessness about Christian orthodoxy, a corruption of Christian obedience, a vacuum of Christian leadership, and a disarray among many of the public initiatives in which Christians have recently placed their confidence. Much of the public face of American Christianity is a stunning testament to the power of religion without God. Much of the private face is an act of indifference to history and human society that borders on disobedience and a gross negligence. The United States has become the storm front of the battle between the gospel and modernity. As we think of the culture and the cultural attitudes toward religion, one of the things we find is that sin is an old-fashioned concept. To speak of sin anymore very much is often laughed at. One popular preacher in our society even defined sin not as missing the mark in terms of our holy character before God, but defined it as simply not maximizing your potential. We also think of God as being for our benefit and that we have no responsibility to Him. So many of the people I talk with on a daily basis wonder, where is God? Why has God let me down? Why did He do this to me? And yet when I inquire as to what their relationship with God is, they basically have no relationship except I trusted Him or I asked Jesus into my heart at a certain time, and from then on, God was supposed to be there for me. It doesn't matter whether I've been there for Him or not. He was supposed to be there for me. But we also find far too often in terms of our cultural attitudes toward religion that our churches are simply a microcosm of the society at large and treat teenagers as kids in many significant ways. One way they do it is by allowing only limited and often not very significant opportunities for service. Again, in my work as a youth minister, I was really bothered by the amount of service that the teenagers could offer to the church. I was thinking as a young adult that they ought to go through training, such as you would train deacons or elders. Not that they would serve yet as a deacon or an elder because of other reasons that we'll get to in a minute. But nevertheless, that they should be trained to do the work and to develop their gifts and to work with a wide variety of ranges of ages in the church. Often the senior high girls would be asked to babysit, but beyond that, they didn't have a very significant role in the church. A second way that we treat teenagers as kids is by having them sit together as a separate group in the worship service. Now, this is not only the church's fault, but I've seen some churches where they built their new great auditorium and they would have a special section for the youth up front. The real reason for that, they would say it was to honor them. I suspect the real reason, perhaps to honor them as well, but another reason at any rate, is to have them up front where everybody can see them so they wouldn't act up so much. I will admit that in the church I worked with, the youth sat in the balcony on the very last row, and eventually I was able to coax them out of that back row and get them to spread out in the with the rest of the congregation. I even encouraged them to sit with their parents, which to some that was unheard of. Still another way that we treat them as kids is by talking down to them. We talk down to them in many ways. There's so many ways to be condescending. either by not including them in significant conversation, by not asking them what they think in terms of not just the youth room, what color we paint the youth room or what kind of furniture they want, but what we do in the sanctuary or the auditorium, or including them in on the voting when they have all the members come in to vote on some congregational matter. They often, even the youth that were members or communicant members, depending on your denomination, how you do that. But they needed to encourage the youth to vote and to vote intelligently. But often they would just dismiss them to have the meeting of the adults, the business meeting. The youth should have been in there and should have been partaking in that. We often treat them as kids by not respecting them and their ideas, not getting their input again. A fifth way is by seeking to coerce commitment primarily through entertainment and slogans rather than challenging them with ideas. We talk down to them, we're condescending with them, and I would suggest we are with the rest of the adults as well, but we're condescending in that we don't offer them good, sound theology. Instead, we offer them slogans, we try to coerce with music and hip ideas and hip little sermonettes, and we think in terms of their short attention span, which, by the way, is not that much shorter, if any shorter, than the rest of the congregation. We challenge them not with strong, deep ideas, but with pablum. And that's not right. It's not fair to them. It's not necessary. And I think it's even sinful, because we're not training them to be salt and light in the real world. Finally, sixth, I would say that we treat them like circus animals when they do something good. The way we treat them like circus animals is we talk about them in terms of, look what our great youth have done and how America's in good hands because of youth like ours. We show them off, and we really violate 1 Timothy 3:6, and we set them up for temptation. 1 Timothy 3:6 talks about not letting an elder or a leader or a ruler be a new convert, because it sets them up to pride. And we often take the youth, and perhaps they've gone out and they've gone on a mission trip and they've returned, and we have them get up in front of everybody and sing and do a lot of wonderful things, and everybody says how wonderful they are. But the truth of the matter is, some of them are wonderful, some of them are not even Christians. We need to be very, very careful about how we set them up, and I think that we can be often very condescending in how we treat them. Now, we all know that we have people in the choir that are not committed Christians, and I don't want to belabor this too much or take it too far, but I think we have to be very careful and understand that we perpetuate the teenagers being kids by the way that we treat them, and we must think it through much better. We don't typically call adults up on stage and treat them the same way that we would our youth groups. Almost as an aside, what I would like to see happening more in churches is mentoring, where older adults take on younger adults, newer converts, and mentor them, build a relationship with them. Why couldn't the youth take up the money on Sunday morning and count it and record it and put it in the safe? I don't mean all youth. I just mean mix them in with the rest of the church. Those kinds of things could be done, and it would be more of a mentoring situation, which would be very helpful and very good. In turn, we can have the youth, say the teenagers, mentor younger people. But even then, we want to have mature teenagers doing that. We don't want our 6-year-olds to see our 17-year-olds telling them about Jesus on Sunday and then see him at the movies during the week, cursing and acting in ways unbecoming a Christian. We want to be careful in our mentoring and have only mature people mentor others. One of the things, I guess, that lays at the foundation of this course, in my opinion, is not so much who are the adolescents that we are going to counsel. That's important, but that's not primary. What's primary is who is the counselor that's going to counsel them. Am I as much a part of the culture as I'm complaining about? Have I taken stock of my life and tried to understand where I am being inconsistent, and am I working to overcome that? One of the things that counselors have to watch out for, of course, is that counselors often are people who are very needy themselves. One of the reasons some of us get into counseling is because we need counseling ourselves, but we're too prideful to go get it. And we think that in some way, by studying counseling or studying psychology, it'll rub off on me and I'll be able to fix myself. Some of us have been through therapy and been helped by it, and in turn want to help others, and those are wonderful motivations. Whatever our reason for getting in it up until now, let me encourage us all that the reason for staying in it and the reason for being a counselor is because God has called us in a special way to minister to people in counseling, and that we take that seriously, and we are going to continue to seek to be holy ourselves, to be devoted to God, not compromising with the world, not telling people what they want to hear, not tickling their ears, as it were, but telling them the truth in love, showing them real caring by studying Scripture enough to know what it says and to know how to apply it to their problems. That's the most compassionate thing we can do. That is the thing that we must do if we're going to be faithful to God. So what the adolescent needs is, yes, for us to understand the adolescent, but more than that, they need us to be godly people so that we have a wealth of information, of experience, to pass on to them. In the next lesson, we'll take on some of the hot topics that concern us about the adolescent and his culture. This is the end of The Adolescent and His Culture, Part 1.